Live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studios, this is Bloomberg Daybreak for Monday, December 3rd, 2018. Coming up this hour.
Global stocks jump as the U.S. and China call a truce to their trade war.
Shares of automakers climb as President Trump said China will remove tariffs on cars.
Oil surges amid output cuts from Canada and an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Russia.
Former President Bush will lie in state at the Capitol ahead of Wednesday's state funeral. Plus, Paris is on edge after violent demonstrations. I'm Michael Barr. More ahead.
I'm John Stashow in sports. A wild win for the Giants in overtime over the Bears. Jets blew a lead, lost to Tennessee, and the Rangers fell overtime to Winnipeg.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak. On Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business App.
Good morning, I'm Karen Moscow.
And I'm Nathan Hager. Bloomberg Daybreak brought to you by PGIM. In the search for Alpha, partner with PGIM, the global investment management businesses of Prudential Financial, Inc.
Stocks are climbing along with Treasury yields as the U.S. and China reach a truce in the trade war. 6:01 on Wall Street, we check the markets every 15 minutes throughout the trading day on Bloomberg. S&P futures up 48 points, Dow futures up 487, NASDAQ futures up 169, the DAX in Germany is up 2.5%, CAC in Paris up 1.7%, and the FTSE 100 up 2.2%. Nikkei 225 in Japan gained 1%, while the Hang Seng in Hong Kong jumped 2.6%. 10-year Treasury down 11 32nds, yield 3.02%, yield on the 2-year 2.83%. NYMEX crude oil up 4.1%, up $2.12 to $53.04 a barrel. COMEX gold up 0.7% or $8.40 to $12.34.40 an ounce. The euro, $1.1333, the yen 113.55. And this update brought to you by Sector Spider ETFs. Why buy a single stock when you can invest in the entire sector? Visit SectorSPDRS.com or call 1-866-SECTOR-ETF. Nathan.
Karen, the dollar is weakening this morning as the U.S. and China declare a truce to the trade war. Presidents Trump and Xi both struck an optimistic tone following their dinner meeting in Argentina. Bloomberg's Eric Schatzker reports from Buenos Aires.
The U.S. gave China 90 days to show progress on reforming its trade practices, and in exchange will hold off on raising tariffs on Chinese imports. Those new tariffs were due to take effect on January the 1st. The White House called the dinner between President Trump and President Xi, quote unquote, highly successful, and China said it had prevented more economic friction. Now we wait to see where China is prepared to make concessions. Eric Schatzker, Bloomberg, Buenos Aires.
All right, Eric, thank you. As part of that truce, the Trump administration says China will increase agricultural imports from the U.S. That has soybean futures in Chicago jumping this morning. Lindsey Greiner is president of the Iowa Soybean Association.
The meeting was a huge breakthrough and I think kind of a sigh of relief on the part of farmers. You know, the details are a little sketchy, but I think it's a very, very good news for farmers.
Those so-called sketchy details come from the White House, which says China will agree to purchase a not yet agreed upon but very substantial amount of agricultural product from the United States.
Now, China's currency is strengthening while stocks around the world surge, with most major indexes up about 2%. Bloomberg macro strategist Mark Cudmore.
I do think this provides a tailwind which can last for several weeks. Overall, what's important is that we've removed the tail risk of Trump and Xi escalating the trade war. The fact that we don't have any concrete deals doesn't really matter. It shows we've removed the most scary outcome, and that means we can get a tailwind for risk assets that can probably last for a couple of weeks into Christmas, maybe into the new year. Then we can start focusing on that deadline again and what kind of progress we're making.
Still, differences on issues like Chinese intellectual property loom large. Tough negotiations lie ahead, with that truce due to expire March 1st.
President Trump is also signaling that Beijing will reduce and remove tariffs on American-made cars. Bloomberg's Jody Schneider has details.
We got this in a tweet from President Trump. He gave no other details. Any move to reduce or eliminate the auto tariffs would be a big benefit for car makers, including Tesla, BMW, and Daimler, which produce cars in the U.S. and import to China. Additional duties have slowed the sales of imported vehicles in China, which remains the world's biggest auto market.
Beijing will neither confirm or deny the president's claim. German automakers are rallying on the news, with shares of BMW and Daimler up more than 7%.
Also rallying, stocks in Asia, they posted their biggest gain in a month following word of the U.S.-China trade truce. Bloomberg's Juliet Sally joins us with the latest from Singapore. Good morning, Juliet.
Good morning, Nathan and Karen. Equities, commodities and bond yields in the region all rose, with the MSCI Asia Pacific Index reaching its highest level since mid-October, led by gains in tech and car makers. Volumes were more than 145% of the three-month average on the index. China's CSI 300, one of the best performers in the region, adding close to 3% on the close. The Aussie dollar, seen as a proxy to the trade war, rallied against the dollar, while EM currencies also gained, with the Korean won at a two-month high. In Singapore, I'm Juliet Sali, Bloomberg Daybreak.
Juliet, thank you. We have several stories impacting oil this morning. Canada's largest oil-producing province is ordering unprecedented output curbs, with plans to cut production by 325,000 barrels a day. At the same time, the leaders of Saudi Arabia and Russia are extending their deal to manage the oil market into 2019. Bloomberg's Stuart Wallace has more.
I think Canada's the big shock, largely because it's unprecedented. We've just never seen anything on this scale. So that's number one. Number two, the fact that Putin was willing to engage, Putin was willing to come out and say, this is a good thing, even if we haven't got any hard numbers for you. The fact that they're still talking to each other and that he's not shunning MBS because of the Khashoggi affair is enormously important. So we've got 3-4 days until the OPEC meeting. That's when we're going to get the hard numbers.
Checking oil now, NYMEX crude is up 4.3%. It's at $53.16 a barrel. Brent is up 4% at $61.84.
And on a somber note, financial markets will close on Wednesday as the nation mourns the loss of former President George H.W. Bush. The New York Stock Exchange and other U.S. markets will shut for a national day of mourning. The Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association has also recommended fixed income cash markets close for the day.
And a programming note, stay tuned this morning for a conversation with Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Richard Clarida. He sits down for an exclusive interview with Bloomberg Radio and Television at 6:30 a.m. Wall Street time. Listen for that 25 minutes from now. Futures again moving higher. S&P futures are up 48 points. Dow futures up 491. NASDAQ futures up 168. Straight ahead, the latest world and national news. This is Bloomberg.
It's Karen 607 on Wall Street. Time to bring in Michael Barr and find out what's happening in the world. Michael?
Thank you very much, Nathan. President George H.W. Bush's body is lying in state at the Capitol today. Wednesday has been designated as a national day of mourning. To pay tribute on the day, a state funeral at the National Cathedral in Washington will be held. His close friend James Baker told ABC's This Week he was at the former president's side on the day he died.
One of his aides said, Mr. President, Secretary Baker's here. Well, he perked up. He opened his eyes. He looked at me. He said, hey, Bake, he said, where are we going? So he kept his spirit and he kept his sense of humor right till the very end.
Meanwhile, the White House says that President Trump will attend the funeral service. Former President Bush's body will be returned to Houston to be laid to rest Thursday. Former FBI Director James Comey says he will testify in a closed-door session with the House Judiciary and House Oversight Committees after filing a legal challenge to force a public hearing. Top House Democrats said allegations that President Trump sought business in Russia longer into the 2016 presidential campaign than he previously suggested raises the possibility that the Russians have compromised his ability to work in the national interest. Representative Adam Schiff, who is expected to take over the House Intelligence Committee next year, says the relationship between Trump and Russia, outlined in a guilty plea by former Trump attorney Michael Cohen, is so deeply compromising.
At the same time that Donald Trump was the presumptive nominee of the GOP and arguing in favor of doing away with sanctions, he was working on a deal that would require doing away with sanctions for him to make money in Russia. That is a real problem.
Schiff spoke on ABC's This Week, which can be heard Sundays on Bloomberg Radio. France's yellow vest anti-government protest intensified over the weekend with vandalism and looting. Bloomberg's Gregory Fascuzzi in Paris reports hundreds were arrested and at least 133 injured.
Emmanuel Macron was at the G20 in Argentina while protesters sacked Paris Saturday. The president returned Sunday to inspect the damage and hold an emergency cabinet meeting, afterwards indicating he's open to dialogue with the so-called yellow vests who oppose his tax and environmental policies. Meanwhile, the protests are expected to go on. In Paris, Gregory Viscusi, Bloomberg Daybreak.
Global News 24 hours a day, on air and at TikTok on Twitter. Powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Michael Barr. This is Bloomberg, Nathan.
Michael, thank you. 6:09 on Wall Street. Time for the Bloomberg NBC Sports Update brought to you by Investors Bank. Here's John Stashower.
Nathan, what a wild game at MetLife. Odell Beckham caught a touchdown pass and for the second time this season threw for one. Chicago got a touchdown run from a 350-pound defensive lineman. Bears also ran a double reverse halfback option pass on the final play of regulation for a game-tying touchdown that capped a furious comeback from down 10 in the last minute, 13 seconds. But in the end, the Giants still won 30-27 in overtime. The coach is Pat Shurmur.
The takeaway is, and I told the team this, I'll keep the swear words out of it, but, you know, some people are fond of talented people. Some people are fond of smart people. I'm fond of tough, resilient people.
Giants have won three of the last four. The only loss was last week in Philadelphia when they blew a 16-point lead. In Nashville, the Jets blew a 16-point lead. The Titans scored in the final minute to win 26-22, stretching the Jets' losing streak to six. And last night, the L.A. Chargers, trailed by 16 in Pittsburgh, came back to stun the Steelers 33-30. The Steelers, in their history, playing at home 175 times, had a halftime lead of at least 16 points. They had never before lost. Arizona yesterday upset the Packers. Green Bay then fired one-time Super Bowl winning coach Mike McCarthy. Speaking of comebacks, at the Garden, Rangers led 3-0 third period. Winnipeg rallied to win 4-3 in overtime. The Blue Shirts' third straight loss had spoiled Vic Hadfield night. Rangers retired the number 11 worn by their captain from the 1970s. With the Bloomberg NBC Sports Update, I'm John Stashower. Nathan?
All right, John, thank you. And markets are starting the month of December surging on the Trump-Xi trade truce. S&P futures ahead 46 points. That's a gain of 1.7%. Dow futures up 486 points right now. NASDAQ futures ahead by 167 points. Price of the 10-year down 10/32. The yield 3.02%. Two-year treasuries at 2.82%. Sports brought to you by Investors Bank. Business wins here. Connect your team with the experts at Investors Bank for business solutions to move your business forward. Investors Bank, banking in your best interest. Member FDIC.
Global news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Business app, and at TikTok on Twitter. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
And I'm Karen Moscow, and this update brought to you by Interactive Brokers, rated number one best online broker 2018 and a top online broker for the eighth consecutive year by Barron's. Visit IBKR.com/YIB to learn more. And futures are jumping with S&P futures up 47 points, Dow futures up 485, NASDAQ futures up 168. The DAX in Germany is up 2.4%. 10-year Treasury down 11/32, yield 3.02%, yield on the two-year 2.82%. NYMEX crude oil up 4.25%, up $2.15 to $53.08 a barrel. COMEX gold is up 0.7%, or $8.80 at $12.34.80 an ounce. The euro, $1.1331, and the yen, 113.52. That's a Bloomberg Business Flash. Now here's Michael Barr with more on what's going on around the world. Michael.
Karen, former President George H.W. Bush's remains will lie in state at the Capitol today. The state funeral service is set for Wednesday at Washington National Cathedral. Meanwhile, the New York Stock Exchange will be closed on Wednesday because of it being a national day of mourning. In the NFL, the Giants won in overtime against the Bears. The Jets lost along with the Raiders and 49ers. The Patriots and Ravens won. Tonight, the Redskins play at the Eagles. In the NHL, the Rangers lost along with the Capitals. Global News 24 hours a day on air and at TikTok on Twitter. Powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Michael Barr. This is Bloomberg, Nathan.
Michael, thank you. We're coming up on 6:19 on Wall Street. Live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studios, this is Bloomberg Daybreak. Let's get you set up for the trading day and week ahead. Helping us to do that from New York, Joe Weisenthal. He's the head of the America's News Desk for Bloomberg News. In London, we're joined by News Director David Merritt. And in Beijing, we're pleased to have Managing Editor Emma O'Brien. Emma, let's start with you. The G20, of course, dominated by the G2. When it comes to the Asian markets this morning, the trade truce between Presidents Trump and Xi seems to be just what the doctor ordered.
That's right. There may be doubt about the legs that this truce has, but the reaction in markets, particularly here in China, shows that investors were willing to take it, at least for today. We saw the steepest surge in a month in Shanghai traded stocks, and the yuan gained almost 1% on the news, the most since 2016. Trump and Xi in that meeting agreed not to slap any new tariffs on each other's goods for 90 days, which takes away that event risk that the markets were trading on for the start of the year, with the risk of tariffs being boosted to 25%. Separate to the market, though, Trump may have called it an incredible deal, but lots of analysts and business groups are coming out of the woodwork saying it's just kicking the can down the road, given it didn't really touch on those key bugbears of the US, that being forced technology transfer, China's Made in China 2025 industrial initiative, and other key issues.
Now, that being said, Joe, we're seeing that optimism reflected certainly in the futures contracts on Wall Street this morning.
Yeah, absolutely. Seeing a pretty big surge. It feels like the vibe has really changed over the last few days. The Fed speak last week was mildly more dovish and sort of market friendly than what we had heard a couple months ago. We're getting more we might get more Powell testimony this week. He's currently scheduled to talk on Wednesday, although we don't know for sure if that will happen because, of course, much of the government will be closed down and the financial markets will be closed down for a day of mourning for former President George H.W. Bush. Nonetheless, the vibe has become much more positive, both the U.S. and globally, thanks to the combination of the tilt in Fed speak and obviously the conciliatory outcome at the G20.
And David Merritt, we're also seeing a positive vibe in the oil market this morning.
That's right. Big gains in oil and very much in focus. We've had the news that Qatar is going to leave OPEC next month. That's a very rare example of a country quitting. It's been a member since 1961. Reflects really the dire relations with Saudi Arabia. The market's shrugging that news off, though, because really focusing in on these big output curbs ordered by Canada and an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Russia to extend an agreement managing the market. So we're seeing Brent crude up more than 5% in London this morning. It has had the worst month in a decade, but a big rally this morning.
Joe, let's go back to you. You mentioned there's a possibility that the testimony from Chairman Powell might be put off because of the National Day of Mourning, but this is still a pretty big week for ECO.
It's a really big week for ECO. The first week of every month tends to be very big for the economic calendar. And, of course, Friday we have the non-farm payrolls report, and that's obviously the number that could change everything. People will be very interested to see if wages are accelerating. It'll be very interesting just to see if the pace of job gains continues because, of course, one always wonders with the market volatility, did we see a slowdown in hiring? We have got a slight pickup in weekly initial jobless claims in the U.S., so that could cause some people to wonder if maybe there's some downside risk to Friday's number. But, you know, it's always the most important number of the month. It's the one that really can move markets and shape the Fed outlook. So regardless of anything else, that'll be huge this week.
David, I wonder if you'll be on the outlook for more market volatility in terms of Brexit. That could be the next big issue for the markets now.
That's right. Yet another turbulent week in prospect. We've just got a little bit over a week to go for this big vote in Parliament on December the 11th. So Theresa May in her final week of real campaigning and the debates will start in Parliament. But I have to say it's not looking good at this point. All predictions are that she is probably going to lose that vote. And the speculation now is what happens next? And really nobody knows the answer to that. Possibly a new election, maybe a new referendum, but certainly some more market volatility as we head into that vote next week.
Emma O'Brien in Beijing, major M&A vote coming up in Asia this week.
That's right. It's one of the biggest deals of the year in Asia and in Europe. It's set to be put to shareholders on Wednesday. That's when investors in Japan's Takeda Pharmaceuticals vote on whether to okay its $62 billion purchase of UK drug maker Shire. While analysts and Takeda's own management, they have indicated it's a shoo-in. There's a very vocal group of dissident investors which are trying to rally more holders to their cause. They're really concerned about the large amount of debt that Takeda needs to take on to buy Shire. And then this opposition group, it only holds about 1% of Takeda shares, said it's concerned about the impact on the company's dividend and also a lack of clarity about the future earnings potential for Takeda, particularly in the U.S. once it takes on Shire's drugs. They acknowledge, though, they face a fairly uphill battle given we're into the home stretch of this one, but it could be an interesting vote on Wednesday.
Emma O'Brien, our managing editor, joining us from Beijing. Also happy to have Bloomberg News Director David Merritt joining us from London, and Joe Weisenthal, head of the Americas News Desk for Bloomberg News, joining us this morning from New York City. And a reminder to stay with us here on Bloomberg Daybreak. We're going to have an exclusive conversation with Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Richard Clarida. He sits down with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Francine Lacroix in just a few minutes here at 6:30 Wall Street time. Futures contracts pointing to a much higher open on Wall Street this morning. You are listening to Bloomberg Daybreak. Bloomberg Daybreak brought to you by BNB Bank. From Montauk to Manhattan, partnering with business in their financial success. With local decision-making, custom solutions, and attention to detail. BNB Bank, many success stories, one bank. BNBBank.com.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York. Bloomberg 1130 to Washington, D.C. Bloomberg 991 to Boston. Bloomberg 1061 to San Francisco. Bloomberg 960 to the country. Sirius XM Channel 119 and around the globe. The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
And it is 6:30 on Wall Street. Good morning. I'm Nathan Hager.
And I'm Karen Moscow. Stocks are rallying around the world after the U.S. and China declared a truce in their trade war.
And now we turn our attention to the Federal Reserve and a discussion with the Vice Chairman, Richard Clarida. He sits down for an exclusive interview with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Francine Lacroix. Let's listen in.
And now we welcome Bloomberg Television and all of you listening worldwide and coast to coast on Bloomberg Radio for a timely conversation with Richard Clarida. To say he is vice chairman of the Federal Reserve barely describes his academics at Columbia University, his work for a small moment with a bond shop out on the West Coast as well. Vice Chairman, we welcome you to the show. Congratulations.
Glad to be here, Tom. Hi.
A lot to talk about, your speech and then Chairman Powell's speech. I want to go to a quote from the gentleman from Andover, the President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush. And this sums up NX, trade. We don't want an America that is closed to the world. What we want is a world that is open to America. I want you to identify for the nation the risk of a zero-sum or neo-mercantile tone within our economics. If we diminish trade, what's the price?
Well, Tom, I think, you know, in terms of the outlook for the U.S. Economy, obviously trade's an important part. I don't think we're going there. Obviously, trade's a very important part of the global economy. Right now, I think the U.S. economy is in good shape, and we can talk about, you know, risky scenarios, but I think the baseline outlook's very solid.
Within the trade is the idea of exports and imports of America. How does Fed policy link into these political debates, or do you feel it will be in the future more removed, more sterile to monetary policy?
Well, I'm not going to get into the politics. I think Fed policy is very important in terms of making sure that the U.S. economy achieves maximum employment and stable inflation, and that's really a dual mandate given to the Fed by the Congress, and we're really focusing on what we need to do with our tools to achieve that mandate.
Chairman Powell focused in his speech at the Economic Club of New York on financial stability. Should that be a mandate of your Fed?
Well, the way that I think about financial stability, it's obviously very important, and the Fed has an important role in supervision and regulation. And also, if we achieve, as we are, price stability and full employment, that itself will contribute to financial stability. So I think that's the appropriate balance.
Let us move to the current dialogue. Yeah. And on Friday, with the news flow, John Williams of San Francisco and also now of the New York Fed with, I thought, a really, really sharp speech. And he goes back. Well, here's some quotes we have from John Williams. The problem we need to solve these days is the risk of inflation that is persistently too low rather than too high. Price level targeting, including its various offshoots, such as nominal GDP targeting, promises to overshoot the target inflation rate in good times to make up for inflation undershoot when policy is constrained. Olivier Blanchard has talked about this as well. Do we need a new regime at the Fed that looks at the combination of real economic growth and price change?
Well, Tom, I think right now the Fed has a framework that's been in place since 2012, and I think it's serving the Fed well. That said, a lot has changed since 2012. And one thing is, as I think my colleague and friend John Williams emphasizes, that we're in a world of what we call the low R-star, low equilibrium riskless rates. And what that means is that in a future downturn, there's less room for conventional monetary policy. And what that means is that central banks need to be just as worried about keeping inflation at target as on going above the target. So I think our current framework serves us well. That said, next year, as we've announced, the Federal Reserve System, including the reserve banks, will be doing an assessment and review of our existing framework, seeking input from a wide range of experts and stakeholders. And we're going to try to get a sense about ways we can perhaps refine our framework.
So much of that input comes from domestic analysis. And each every conversation I see is on the global economy as well. Is there a disinflationary impulse out there, separate from the Fed, separate from America, that you have to consider?
I think those forces really have been at work now, Tom, since maybe I first started doing your show almost 20 years ago. Globalization is a factor that certainly can have a disinflationary impact through a number of channels. We are in a world where, you know, central banks, including the Fed, are focused on keeping inflation away from disinflation.
Professor Clarida, let's go to Columbia. You're in Econ 101. You're doing an Ec 10 thing like Marty Feldstein and Greg Mankiw up at Harvard. What is a Powell put? How would you define that? Our Michael McKee says Powell put is media language. It's this, you know, it's out there. What's it actually mean to authorities?
Well, I think Mike got that right. I don't really think of it as a useful way to describe what the current Federal Reserve is doing, or frankly, a useful way to describe what term first came up about maybe 20 or so years ago. What we're really focused on, Tom, with 3.7% unemployment and inflation around 2, is pursuing a policy that makes sure the economy can sustain this good performance. So it's just, I think, not a useful concept for us to think about a particular put in a particular market.
Are the dots a useful concept? You never taught that, I am most certain, at Columbia. There's been experiments and forward guidance. I made a joke with Mr. Trichet the other day, the idea of la boule de cristal. Come on, we're all looking forward, and the worst offender are the dots. Can we lessen the dots or do away with the dots?
Well, let me say this. I think the Fed is always and currently looking at ways that we can potentially refine, improve our communication. The dots, or, you know, the SEP projections have been in place since 2012. And, you know, they're not going anywhere, but over time they may evolve, as all our communications have.
Define data dependency. Translate that.
Well, thank you.
Within academics, is data dependency part of the literature, or was it invented for the moment?
Oh, no. Data dependency in terms of monetary policy, certainly goes back at least 25 years to the seminal work of John Taylor. And it's, of course, evolved and has different perspectives. But the main point about data dependence is you need to be setting monetary policy based upon the data of the economy. You know, booming economies require a different policy than depressed economies. But there's a second point that I raised in my speech last week, Tom, here in New York, is that we're also in a world where I would argue there's a second form of data dependence. And the data is telling us something about the ultimate destination for the economy. Where are rates ultimately headed in terms of the neutral rate? And where is the level of full employment? And those are key inputs that are unobserved that we have to infer from the data.
If we overshoot, I mean, the risk of an overshoot, we do the data guess and the Fed reacts and all the parlor game that we talk about every day. What are the risks of an overshoot of a little too much inflation? I spoke with Craig Torres of Bloomberg News. He asked these piercing press conference questions to Chairman Powell. What exactly is the risk of an overshoot?
Okay. Well, right now, you know, inflation, depending on how it's measured and over the time frame, is right at our 2% target. The Fed has said, certainly before my arrival 10 weeks ago or so, we have a symmetric objective around 2%. Mm-hmm. 2% is not meant to be a ceiling. We've operated below 2%. We could operate somewhat above 2%, depending upon the shocks. But ultimately, we want to run policy that gets inflation
this
back.
This is critical. Vice Chairman Clarida, and I can do this with a great friendship that you and I have had for years. You say you have a symmetric projection. It's an asymmetric world. We don't live in perfect geometry, Walrasian equilibrium, and that. I want the equation yet, Riley. This is too important. But it's an asymmetric world, isn't it?
It is an asymmetric world, and getting back to your question a moment ago, in recent decades, the asymmetry has been towards disinflation forces. And central banks have to run policies to offset that if they can.
Here's 1999. Chris Condon, thank you so much for bringing this up. Bring up that equation here. We got a little ahead. This is Blinder, the former vice chairman, talking about the dark art. And for radio, I've got to spell this out for radio. Pi equals E, the summation of a big beta. And that's a lambda sign there as we go up. This is from 1999 Clarida. This is the world that you guys worked in 1999 and with Clarida Gertler and the rest of it. Does that mathiness work anymore?
Tom, I think it's a starting point. I think any model, including the work I did with Gertler and Galley, is a starting point, but it's not the destination. You know,
what's the destination?
Well, the destination is the right policy that understands the economy as it is, not as it how it might be approximated in a model. So I've never thought of being handcuffed to a model, but it's a good place to start to develop intuition.
Those models and that intuition, you're going to have to advise Chairman Powell on. It's a great, you got a business guy and, frankly, the historian from Princeton with one of our arch monetary theorists. Day to day, how do you work with the chairman? You're not giving him equations like that.
Well, we sometimes talk about equations like that, but that's just one very small part of it. You know, I've just been working with Chair Powell now for several months, but we have a great working relationship. Our backgrounds complement one another. And, of course, he has a lot more experience as a Federal Reserve official than I do. I think when I attended my first board meeting, I think that was his 50th or 60th. So certainly there's a range of perspectives at the Fed, Vice Chair Quarles, Governor Brainard, Mickey Bowman, and the Reserve Bank President. So it's a very, very productive and effective.
What do you hear from the Reserve Bank Presidents right now? Give us a Clarida beige book as we go into December.
Well, certainly. I'm not going to discuss any conversation.
I got to make some news here. Come on.
Well, I know, but Tom, I'm not going to be making any news today. At least that's not the intention. No, I think we benefit in our system with having the 12 Reserve Banks, which represent their geographies and their perspectives. And a big part of the beige book, as you recommended, is the contacts and the granular access to information they have in their reserve district. So it's an important part of our process.
Mr. Vice Chairman, thank you so much. Richard Clarida.
Talk on Twitter, powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Michael Barr. This is Bloomberg. Nathan?
Michael, thank you. We are live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studios, where it's coming up on 6:47 on Wall Street. Time now to check what's going on in D.C. As Michael mentioned, the nation is going to pause to mourn the late George H.W. Bush in just a few days. Ahead of that, three of the 41st president's closest aides shared their reflections on his legacy on the Sunday political talk shows. Former Secretary of State James Baker appeared on all four of the programs you hear on Bloomberg Radio. He told Fox News Sunday that he was by the former president's side in his final hours.
His last words, the last words George Bush ever said were, "I love you." And he said those words to 43, George Bush, President George Bush, 43.
Colin Powell served as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Bush 41 administration. He tells ABC's This Week the former president was the perfect American.
In terms of how he served the country in so many different capacities, in Congress, as the envoy to China, in business, all the things that he did throughout his life.
And on CBS Face the Nation, former Vice President Dick Cheney, who was Bush's defense secretary, said he was the right man to lead following the Cold War.
He was superb. And then his leadership in the Gulf War was really remarkable.
The other big news this week, President Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen pleading guilty to lying to Congress about then-candidate Trump's business ventures in Russia during the campaign. Incoming House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler tells NBC's Meet the Press.
One question has always been, why was the president so obsequious to Putin from the beginning of the campaign up to the present day? And it may be that it's because the Kremlin has leverage over the president.
And ABC's This Week spoke with someone else in special counsel Robert Mueller's crosshairs, Roger Stone. Mueller's investigating the longtime Trump advisor's ties to WikiLeaks and hacked Democratic emails, asked whether he expects a pardon from President Trump.
There's no circumstance under which I would testify against the president because I'd have to bear false witness against him. I'd have to make things up, and I'm not going to do that. I've had no discussion regarding a pardon.
It's just some of the conversation from the political shows you hear every Sunday here on Bloomberg Radio, starting with NBC's Meet the Press at 11 a.m. Wall Street time, followed by Fox News Sunday at noon, ABC's This Week at 1 p.m., and Face the Nation from CBS at 2 p.m. Sundays on Bloomberg Radio. Now let's get more on what's going to drive the week on the nation's capital. Bloomberg Washington reporter Kathleen Hunter joins me now. Let's pick up on the conversation about the Russia investigation. Kate, it does look as though Michael Cohen's guilty plea is giving Democrats more fodder.
Absolutely. I think that there are a lot of fresh questions, as we just heard, about, you know, what kind of leverage the Kremlin might have over the president, given that the real revelation or the main revelation out of Cohen's latest guilty plea last week was that the president's intense negotiations and business dealings with Moscow went well into the summer of 2016, which is much longer than previously stated. And so I think that certainly has raised some new questions about, first of all, what leverage that might have given the Kremlin, that in and of itself, and then also what other aspects of Trump's relationship with Russia and with the Kremlin might still be unknown.
Yeah, I guess these are going to be questions that are probably going to be put off, not just by the fact that Democrats don't take over Congress until next month, but the passing of former President George H.W. Bush. It's probably going to dominate not just the conversation in Washington this week, but a lot of the action with the nation taking a pause.
Yeah, and I think that it's a bit interesting to see that, you know, given how much the sort of tone in Washington has changed under the Trump administration, you know, there's certainly a lot more acrimony than there was previously. There's a lot less bipartisanship, but there still is, you know, from kind of the sense of comedy around the idea of taking a pause and stepping back and honoring the life and legacy of President Bush, you know, this week, and sort of putting these political fights a little bit on the shelf for a few days at least. You know, Washington's kind of expert at doing that and then turning right back to the sparring. So I don't think it will last very long, but I think it's interesting that, you know, in these modern times, we're still seeing potentially a fight over funding the government being put off for a few more days. The current funding was set to expire on Friday, and now they're talking about potentially putting that off by another week or two to sort of take a pause and not be having that fight, you know, right as they're sort of trying to come together in a bipartisan way to honor the former president.
Yeah, it is interesting that you note that Washington does seem to be getting used to these sorts of pauses. Because, I mean, it wasn't all that long ago, what, a month or two ago that that we paused to honor the late Senator McCain. And now it is almost a repeat.
That's true. Although I will note that, you know, and you'll remember, obviously, Nathan, that, you know, during that time, there was a bit of political controversy at the time, because initially the White House wasn't going to lower their flags to half staff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I think that, you know, again, this time around, it's a bit interesting that, you know, we're seeing this sort of full pause and not, you know, so far we're not really seeing a lot of politics creep in. You know, I think that was with the McCain situation, that was a bit of an anomaly, I think. And, you know, it's interesting that we're not seeing that this time around.
Yeah, but talking about the pause affecting whether we're going to see a government shutdown fight, there had been some talk that that was going to happen this week with funds running out on Friday. Now it appears as though something else that we're used to in Washington, the can getting kicked down the road for a week or two.
Yeah, Congress is does nothing better than potentially putting off difficult decisions by another, you know, week, month, year, whatever it takes. So in some ways, that's not surprising. And I think that, you know, there is some argument just strategically for leadership to both do it for 1 week or for 2 weeks. 1 week, you know, is a little bit more low stakes because that gives them some additional time to work things out if they push it back until December 14th. If they go a week further to the 21st, then they're getting very, very close to Christmas. And that has kind of a double-edged sword because in some ways, you know, that provides leverage for leadership to try to get legislation through because nobody really wants to be there on Christmas Eve working. However, the downside of that is that if that strategy doesn't work, then they're there Christmas Eve working. So it's a bit of a more high stakes approach to push it further off.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about President Trump's performance at the G20, whether that's going to have any impact on what happens in Washington this week. It's certainly having an impact on the markets this morning.
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, the new normal has sort of become shifted where what we expect to come out of this is out of these types of summits is acrimony, is, you know, some sort of viral tweet from Trump or some sort of unexpected jab at allies. And really, we didn't see that this time around. Things went pretty smoothly. It was almost sort of, you know, more routine, more what we're used to seeing coming out of these summits in previous administrations. There was, you know, kind of a trade truce struck, which in and of itself shouldn't be downplayed in terms of its potential significance. So I think that this is a bit of a sign that potentially the Trump administration is learning to navigate these types of waters a bit better than it did initially.
Bloomberg Washington reporter Kathleen Hunter, thanks as always. You can read more about these stories on Bloomberg.com or on the Bloomberg Terminal. And a reminder that you can follow all the latest on Bloomberg Radio in Washington. Just tune in to Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2. Karen.
All right, Nathan, thank you. And with the G20 summit behind us, Wall Street will have plenty to contend with this week. We get a preview from Bloomberg's Charlie Pellett.
We'll be getting plenty of economic data, November auto sales, lots of Fed speakers, an OPEC meeting, and a smattering of earnings. Tobias Lefkovich is chief U.S. equity strategist at Citigroup Global Markets.
Expectations for 2019 in September were for earnings growth, consensus numbers of 12%. Now we're down below 9%. Our view is 6%, and we think we're going to see those numbers come down into that 6-7% range, at which point companies can meet or beat. If you're constantly missing, stocks don't go up.
Among the companies reporting quarterly earnings this week, the discount retailer Dollar General, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, Toll Brothers, yoga wear maker Lululemon, H&R Block, and Broadcom. Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Daybreak.
Charlie, right, thank you. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the head of General Motors will do some damage control this week. Bloomberg's Bob Moon reports.
Lawmakers erupted in outrage over GM's plan to shed thousands of jobs and cancel production at four U.S. plants. And congressional staffers say Chief Executive Mary Barra will meet with representatives of states affected by the cutbacks, including Democrats Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Gary Peters of Michigan. Last week, Michigan's Debbie Dingell said GM had managed to unite both parties in anger, with President Trump also sharply critical.
This has to be the most thoroughly disliked company in Washington, D.C. right now.
Lawmakers call Barra especially heartless for announcing as many as 15,000 job cuts just a few weeks before Christmas. Bob Moon, Bloomberg Daybreak.
All right, Bob, thank you. On the economic front, we start the week with a pair of reports on American factories from the Institute for Supply Management and the research firm Market. Bloomberg's Vinnie Dal Giudice has more.
There's evidence manufacturing is slowing as White House tariffs take hold. The ISM factory index hit a six-month low in October. What's more, the Market U.S. manufacturing PMI has been drifting. Also on today's economic calendar, October construction spending. Its September construction spending leveled off after two consecutive monthly gains. Higher mortgage rates have hurt housing. Vinnie Dal Giudice, Bloomberg Daybreak.
All right, Vinnie, thank you. And we are watching the markets this morning. Stocks are climbing alongside Treasury yields. The dollar falling after the U.S. and China declared a truce in their trade war. Oil is surging as Saudi Arabia and Russia extended their pact to manage the market. And Canada's largest producing province ordered unprecedented output curbs. S&P futures currently up 42 points. Dow futures up 448, or about 1.8%. And Nasdaq futures are up 150. The DAX in Germany up 2.3%. The CAC in Paris up 1.25%. And the FTSE 100 is up 2%. The Nikkei 225 in Japan gained 1%, while the Hang Seng in Hong Kong was up 2.6%. 10-year Treasury down 12/32nds, yield 3.03%. The yield on the 2-year, 2.83%. NYMEX crude oil up 4.25%, or $2.16, to $53.09 a barrel. And COMEX gold up 0.7%, or $8.20 to $12.34.20 an ounce. Straight ahead, it's Bloomberg Surveillance with Tom Keene and Jonathan Farrow. For Nathan Hager, I'm Karen Moscow, and this is Bloomberg.